You're not just getting a building. You're getting a whole process that is engendering community. It's connecting people. It's promoting integration. It's promoting skill sharing, mastery, understanding of other groups. And why can't every building be like this? I just see it as a wasted opportunity. And I think it's just a waste of resources.
This is the fourth episode of the Disobedient Buildings podcast, an HRC-funded project at the University of Oxford. Our focus is on the everyday life of people living in aging blocks of flats in three European countries, the UK, Romania, and Norway. My name is Anna Ulrike Andersen, and today I take you to Oslo, where I speak with Else Abrahamsen and Jack Hughes from the architectural firm Makers Hub, talking about participatory-led design.
We're a architecture office and volunteer organization. We focus on participatory design and participatory methods in architecture. And we do a number of different scales of projects, mainly the buildable scale, because we focus on self-building as our kind of strongest participatory method. And we work from outdoor projects, projects in parks, outdoor furniture, interior work, small-scale structures, all of that. And we're a small group right now. It's Elsa and I, but we have a lot of volunteers who are part of our network who kind of come and go when they can, when they're available.
We also specialize in reaching a specific user group because we believe that architecture today is, the majority of architecture is, in our opinion, unfortunately, more directed towards the people who have the means. So we want to give people who don't have a voice in the architectural industry a voice through our projects. We like to say that we work with the forgotten people and the forgotten spaces, and that's our main focus.
How do you find the forgotten voices? What do you do to reach out to people who might not necessarily be in architecture already, or think about architecture, or even, you know, consider that this is something that they want to participate in?
It's pretty easy in a sense to understand what groups are underrepresented in architecture, because architecture is a game of the rich. It's a game of the privileged, you know. It's like all people in society, they all use architecture all the time. But what happens with the wealthy is they choose their architecture, they craft their architecture, and then they make their spaces. But the underprivileged are handed spaces, often left over, forgotten from older projects or from older things.
We are not shy, we are pushy, and we take contact with people and also the public governments and actually tell them that you should include this user group more. Let's create a project. For example, I think it was 2 years ago, we started up a project with a youth club in the borough of Gamle Oslo. And we were so lucky here because the person in the borough, he actually knew our work from before, because we had done a lot of volunteer work on one of the city's asylum centers. So we were given the freedom of proposing a method and a way of working, and they listened and they gave us completely freedom to develop this method and experiment along the way. With the youth club, for example, we facilitate for the teenagers to participate into the co-designing with us. We are not this like one great designer who makes a pretty space. Our main role is actually to facilitate for the teenagers to take space and credibility in our processes.
Teenagers we work with are from underprivileged areas of the city. and they are marginalized. So when we develop the youth club for them and with them, most importantly, this space becomes something that's cool, it becomes something beautiful, and it becomes something functional. All of those different elements, and those help with the functional aspects, help with like safety, help with privacy, help with comfort, help with keeping the place clean, you know, all of these kind of contribute to dignity. But then the aesthetics help with that kind of more emotional experience of a space where they say like, okay, this is ours. Like, we own this space and we feel comfortable here. We feel safe here. We're emotionally connected to this and we feel proud of this space.
With this idea of designing with the participants or the people that you work with, once you maybe then leave your ego behind, then something new and unexpected can take place and occur. And I wondered if you have you experienced that in your projects, that you come in with maybe certain expectations, even if you try, you know, to leave those behind, and then the youth, for example, that you work with come up with something unexpected and very intriguing. Have you experienced that?
My favorite version of this is Elsa had been going to the youth club every, was it Tuesday or Wednesday, just kind of like hanging out with the teenagers, just getting ideas from having conversations. It was very kind of free form research. And then we kind of went, okay, now we have to create a plan for the space. You know, we have to. So we created 6 proposals and we made them as 1 to 20 models, very, very big models, so that they could really understand and look at them. Some of them had like couches, kind of like built-in couches. Some of them had like, we created this kind of like big form in the room that was like this kind of object that they could move around. She would have like TVs in and like gaming stations and, you know, all these different things. And as we workshopped the ideas, the kids, they would just take the models apart. And basically they just kept adding more sofas. And just kept adding more sofas in different arrangements, and until the room became basically like one giant built-in sofa. And we were so astounded by this because in a way it's architecturally a bit of a boring solution. It wasn't what we were thinking, like that's what we'll give them, you know. It's almost like it would have been like, we thought it would have been patronizing or something to give them that solution. But what they wanted and what they needed was a living room, or a stuo, we say in Norway. They wanted a place that was a cozy place to relax and talk and chill out. They didn't want to be experimental with their architecture. They wanted to be cozy and have a place that was like their room, their own space. And it was just such a revelation to us because it was not the solution we had proposed. So if we did not do the participatory method, we would not have got to that point.
And this is a completely different kind of entry point to how you do architecture than most big architecture projects. Like, we are not creating projects that look good on our portfolio. We're not creating these like pretty magazine pictures. We're creating the spaces for these people, and that's what we care about.
Yeah, I think, you know, I know you because I signed up to volunteer for one of your projects. I'm not a trained architect and I'm not great with building things, but, you know, even I could easily put these blocks of wood together, and it was very low, how do you say in English?
Low threshold.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel that you were actually able to do these kind of things that you probably never have done before?
I went for a walk last night and I walked through that area and I was like, oh, I was part of, you know, putting this together, and it made me feel a lot more connected to that space.
What makes me happy to hear, Anna, is that you're pinpointing a few points that we want to achieve with every project that we do. Number one is that we form our designs for unskilled people to build them. And then the second thing is also that when we do project like this, it's really important that you leave your ego at the door. You are not the superior architect who knows the best for everyone else. You need to listen and then adapt.
For me, which was very interesting, is the sense of like, what is participation and what does it do and where is participation? So like when you're talking about a sense of empowerment from working, like we like to say, you know, that we give empowerment with power tools, that just the fact of like learning how to use these saws and drills gives you a sense of, you know, mastery and ability to like, okay, I can do this.
I think I want to give an example of, well, this is not the correct word saying that a project went wrong, but for the Olafur project that you actually participated in volunteering, like 1 year ago, we were supposed to have the first kind of kickoff launch event for that project. But then COVID-19 happened and we had to cancel all of our planned activities. And those planned activities were, for example, workshops where we were like intending to co-design the space with the people in the neighborhood. But unfortunately, we weren't able to do that because of COVID. And I would say, like, when Jack and I reflect back on it, like, we had to, in a very, very quick and very cheap way, we had to design something because kind of time were running out and we couldn't wait any longer because we have kind of a window of building, which is during the summer months here in Oslo. And so we didn't have co-designing in that project. And I think both of us, we feel that was kind of the missing key ingredient for us. Even though if it was a co-building project in the end with like a massive volunteer effort put into the building of it, we, from our perspective, we didn't feel that people got like the, let's say, the proper way of ownership to the space because we couldn't do the co-designing. And when we reflect on that as an example, like, it just reminds us of how important that part actually is in our projects.
Our work is about how important public space is and how important people meeting physically is and how important face-to-face contact is and how important public space is in creating a societal connectiveness. And basically Corona is the antithesis of that philosophy and that practice.
But it's such a such a good point though. I mean, how certain things that we do in our everyday life and our work, it's completely fine to do remotely and from our home offices. And then there are other things like the kind of work that you do that it's not the same calling someone, or, you know, it's not, and you might not even reach the people you want to co-design with. I've been looking into blocks that are quite central in Oslo, so Gamle Oslo, so that area. When visiting your website, many of your projects are based in that area, and I also think that it also is the part of the city that has the most forgotten spaces, as you would call them, and also maybe the forgotten people.
I absolutely love working in that area. It is so complex, and the Olafur project was probably the most complex participation that we have ever done, also because it's so polarizing.
It exists as a collision between a kind of poor area and 1970s infrastructure projects, physical barriers like a river, train lines. So first of all, this is an incredibly diverse community and one of the most diverse in all of Norway. And that community is complex in its diversity. And it's of Norwegians, of immigrants. So I have never, ever seen a more complex urban space.
And I think it also should be mentioned that in this specific part of the city, the child poverty is actually increasing. For me, that is just mental. Like, we have more kids in that area who are growing up in poverty in the context of Norway. And that is bad. Like, that line of a graph is going the wrong way.
One participant, you know, we asked them to write a letter about what worries you. And she answered, you know, I'm worried about bikes being stolen, even though it's locked and in the locked bike room. Another participant in a postcard speaks quite directly about feeling a privilege, experiencing a privilege in the way, you know, where she lives. And I think it's quite striking to see then how that you do see this inequality, and you see like a gap in within such a small part of the city.
And then also our co-building projects, we also aim for that to be an arena for people from different social classes to actually meet. We employed certain people with a certain background to come and work with us, and we paid them salaries. And then we invite volunteers, just whoever, open call. And usually our volunteers are actually work immigrants, I would say, or locals who are want to do something nice for the community. And in a way, you work shoulder to shoulder with someone who might not have the same life as you. And you actually manage to meet people who are completely different from you in our building processes. So in a way, what they're building is not necessarily the most interesting part for the volunteers. It's actually the people that they might meet at their workshops. So this is also a way that we work with inclusion and integration. And this borough, it's so extremely divided.
And I think this ties in very interestingly to your work on tower blocks, and especially aging tower blocks, this idea of a utopia. That, okay, we'll have like airy apartments that are lifted off the ground with light and all of these things. And we'll have this modernist dream, similar to the modernist dream of around Olafia, these motorways moving through the city. You know, when you force your utopian ideal upon someone else, you know, like, what are the results? And I think the urban space has been healing from the wounds of that. Who are the people who it's experimented on? It's experimented on the working class. It's experimented on the underprivileged in society. Like, what are the wounds from that lack of participation, you know? So to me, participation isn't just a cozy, nice thing. It's actually a cure to a dystopian reality.
Thank you for listening to the Disobedient Buildings podcast, edited by myself and produced by Jack Soper. If you want to hear more, go to our website www.disobedientbuildings.com or search for a podcast where you normally find your podcasts. In the next episode, Inge Daniels takes you to London to speak with Jackie Peacock from Advice for Renters. What kind of housing problems can be experienced in London today?